Our reading tonight is from James chapter 3 and beginning to read at verse 1. Not many of you should presume to be teachers, my brothers, because you know that we who teach will be judged more strictly. We all stumble in many ways. If anyone is never at fault in what he says, he is a perfect man, able to keep his whole body in check. When we put bits into the mouths of horses to make them obey us, we can turn the whole animal. Or take ships as an example. Although they are so large and are driven by strong winds, they are steered by a very small rudder wherever the pilot wants to go. Likewise, the tongue is a small part of the body, but it makes great boasts. Consider what a great forest is set on fire by a small spark. The tongue also is a fire, a world of evil among the parts of the body. It corrupts the whole person, sets the whole course of his life on fire, and is itself set on fire by hell. All kinds of animals, birds, reptiles, and creatures of the sea are being tamed and have been tamed by man. But no man can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil, full of deadly poison. With the tongue, we praise our Lord and Father, and with it, we curse men who have been made in God's likeness. Out of the same mouth come praise and cursing. My brothers, this should not be. Can both fresh water and salt water flow from the same spring? My brothers, can a fig tree bear olives, or a grapevine bear figs? Neither can a salt spring produce fresh water.
Good evening, everyone. Is anybody here thinking about the summer holidays? Yes. Anybody here booked the summer holidays yet? Well, I've booked mine. And when you go on holiday, it's good to have some tips, isn't it, about things that would be good to take with you, something that will help you on your way. So this afternoon I was looking on my bookshelf and I've picked up this handbook of travellers from the Royal Geographical Society, 1937. And I just thought that if you were thinking about going on holiday, there might be some of you who are maybe thinking about going to Tibet. And so I thought I'd bring you some wisdom from this handbook of travel. About yaks. Because if you were thinking about getting a yak, it's quite important. There are some tips that you need to know. Okay, so I'm just going to read you something about what's the best thing to do with yaks. Okay? Yaks should never be bought, but hired at the rate of 1 rupee each day, which includes the services of one man for 6 animals. They move in herds and are clumsy in file, except on a beaten track uphill in the snow. Unladen yaks are very useful in opening snow passes. Take them up by night on the hard snow and drive them down again on the soft snow in the morning. The yak can keep on going indefinitely at around 1.5 miles per hour. His load is the same as a pony, 160 pounds. The yak does not like the scent of a European who should not stand near during the loading. So, if you were going to go to Tibet and you were thinking about hiring some yaks, just remember, stand well clear of the yaks. Now, I know that obviously probably nobody here is going to go to Tibet, but handbooks, useful things, because I knew nothing about yaks before I looked at that this evening, and now I do. And we're looking at James on a Sunday evening, and the letter of James is a bit like a handbook. It's a bit like a handbook of practical Christianity. It's full of snippets of good advice for Christian living, which are as relevant today as they were 2,000 years ago. And those who know more about these things than I do, they seem to be content that the book of James was written by Jesus' brother, James, Jesus' brother. And it was written about 60 AD, and at that time, James was a leader in the Jerusalem church. So he was a figure that people look up to, a bit like Brian. Only a little bit like Brian. Anyway, and we're not quite sure what the purpose of the letter was, but James is clearly a wise and respected leader, which is why people think maybe it was the brother of Jesus, and why, because he was the leader of the Jerusalem church. So, 60 AD, we're one generation on from Jesus' death on the cross. So the early church has been going for a generation. And over that period of time, lots of different things have happened. The church has spread out a little bit, and it's likely that certain things have happened, and as the church has spread away from the centre, people aren't quite sure what to do about certain things. So the good thing about James is that nobody's quite sure what the purpose of it is, nobody's quite sure who it's sent to, nobody's really sure who it was written by, which means that people like me can sort of speculate and create things around to help us to understand. So the way I look at this letter of James, it's a bit like if he was alive now, James would probably have a website, and it would be called Ask James. And it would be, any questions about the local church, just send them through to askjames.com. And he would sort them out for you. Or like in a newspaper, if you buy that sort of newspaper, I don't read that kind of newspaper, but certain newspapers have got like pages where they say, oh, I've got trouble with my dog, he won't walk with me, and I don't know what to do, can you help me please? And they'll write in and they'll say, somebody with some wisdom will come out. Well, if you read through James, it's a bit like that. It's like the collected wisdom of James, the elder statement in the church at the time. And if you read the whole book, you'll see that it addresses lots of concerns in the church, but it particularly focuses on the idea of unity and how to deal with behaviour in the church, which is divisive. So he talks about what people are doing and they shouldn't be, and what they're not doing, and what they should do. And if you read all the way through, it talks about things like trials and temptations, favoritism, a lack of charity, gossips, quarrels, boasting, the selfish rich. It sounds like the storyboard from a soap opera. And now this is interesting, because if you read in Acts, the church, you read in Acts 4, the church is, it's all together, they're living in harmony, they're sharing all their things, they're helping all the poor. But it seems from the things which James is addressing in his epistle, just a generation on, this isn't quite the church which is there at the time. It would probably be a church which is a mixture of Jews and Gentiles, a mixture of slave and free, and they would know that in God's sight everybody is equal. But it's apparent from the things which James is talking about that they're not, that the church is actually fracturing down economic and social fault lines. So there are elements on there where there are obviously poorer people, there are top dogs and there are bottom dogs. There's things about don't have favourites in the church, don't give them special chairs, make sure that your faith is backed up by deeds. If these weren't issues which were in the church, he wouldn't really have talked about them. So it's clear that things are beginning to slip away from the Acts ideal for what the church is like. And all of this kind of maelstrom of egos of all these different people in the church, it's undermining what the church is meant to be about. So James's letter is an urgent call for the church to repent and be united. And if you look through the book, there of the 108 verses, there are no less than 54 commands. Do this, do that, don't do this, don't do that. So he doesn't beat about the bush. He gets in there and he leaves the reader in no doubt that something has got to be done. It is an Indiana Jones letter. to the younger people. Just so that you're listening, an Indiana Jones action-packed letter full of things, exciting things that are happening. And within all of that spectrum which he deals with, he saves his harshest word for the tongue, which is what we're going to look at tonight. And it appears to cast a shadow over everything which the church is under threat for. So although the main teaching is in chapter 3, which we're going to come to in a minute, if you just look across the rest of the book, the tongue is getting mentioned elsewhere, or people saying things. In chapter 1, verse 19, you see that it says, everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry. Now, if we just adopted that one verse in our lives, we might find it makes a lot of difference to our relationships. In chapter 4, verse 11, it says, brothers, do not slander one another. Anybody who speaks against his brother or judges him speaks against the law and judges it. So he directly mentions what the tongue does. But he also, when he's talking about all these other dangers to the church, he also quotes people. He gives examples of what people might say as another illustration of using the tongue in this book. So, for example, in chapter 2, verse 3, he says, if you show special attention to the man wearing fine clothes and you say, here's a good seat for you, or to the poor man, you say, stand there, or sit on the floor by me. So he's giving an illustration where the tongue is actually being used in the way which is dividing the church. So it's clear from James's point of view that wherever there's trouble in the church, the tongue is never far away. So, turning to chapter 3. Now, I've got a PowerPoint, Ian. Have you got it there? I've just got a few slides to help us to focus on what this passage is telling us. There's just three points to the passage that I want to look at. The terror of the tongue, the teacher of the tongue, and the taming of the tongue. So looking at the first thing, the terror of the tongue. So if James's letter was a film, then from the introduction that I've just given, I hope you can see that the tongue would be the bad guy. He'd be the guy that the good guys were after. But how can something which is so small cause such a problem? Well, this is the issue which James is addressing in chapter 3, verses 1 to 12. According to James, there are three terrors of the tongue. And the first terror is its impact on our lives. Now, it's 20 years. No, it's not. Yes, it is. It's 20 years since I left university. And when I left university, one of the first jobs I got was working in Norwich Union. Because I'm such a man of the corporate firm. I wanted to give my entire life to a worthy cause. So I was temping at Norwich Union. And there was a girl at Norwich Union who I... Don't tell my wife this because she's not here. But I quite liked this girl. But I was just a meagre temp. And she was permanent. She was a full-time member of staff. But one day, I plucked up the courage. And I said to her, outrageous, I said, do you fancy going out for a cup of tea after work? Now, is that a threatening request? Is that the kind of request which you would not want a boy to ask your daughter? I wouldn't think so. But you know what she said? She said, no. Can you believe that? She said, no. And I was such a charming gentleman as well. So that was like one small word that she said. But basically, for a small while, maybe 5 or 10 minutes, I was crushed. You know, I was like, oh, she's rejected me. How could she possibly do that? Oh, sorry. So, the tongue is tiny, and yet it has got an impact on our lives. Skipping to verse 9, it says, with the tongue we praise God and we curse men. It's a versatile thing. Just a simple little thing can have a huge impact on our lives. Which do you think you're better at doing? Are you better at praising people? Or are you better at, perhaps not cursing them, but putting them down? So have a think about when the last time was that you actually said something nice to somebody. when you said, that was a lovely meal, or that was a beautiful dress, or what a fantastic pair of shoes, or I don't know, something like that. To your friends, or to your wife, or to your children. And when was the last time that you said something critical? When was the last time you said, oh, these beans are cold, or shut the door, or can't you drive, or any one of a number of potential things that obviously good Christian people like you wouldn't say to somebody close to you, but imagine that you might do. Just have a think. Why not witness the impact of the tongue for yourselves after the service? So find somebody and just go to them and say, I think you are lovely, and I really love you being in this church. And just see what happens to them. There you go, a little experiment when you get back out. So the impact can be amazing. You can bring somebody up, you can make them, give them a little bit of a high, or you can knock somebody down. And the choice of that is yours. It's not the choice of the person you talk to. It's your choice. You don't have to do that. You don't have to do either of those things. But we're all of us make those choices. We all of us choose to build people up or knock them down. So it does have impacts on people's lives. And this is what James is going on about in verses 3 and 4, when he says we put the bits into the mouths of horses and we make them obey us. Or take a ship, and though they are large and steered by a very small rudder, they go where the pilot wants them to go. And the tongue is the same. Although it's only small, it changes what you are like as a person and how people see you. So if you say sincere and honest things which build people up, then that turns you round as an individual. If you say destructive, crushing things, then that turns you round another way. And also, if we are the recipient of those, and if anybody has known, as I'm sure we all have here, people who said things that have just crushed us like that girl did, we all know the impact of that. The tongue can be a terror. It is the only tool which sharpens with use. Okay, so the second terror of the tongue is its destructive potential. So it can do terrible damage. When I was looking into this sermon, I looked up a website called Celebrity Rumours. I thought this should be fun. I was amazed that I can't believe there's a website which is called Celebrity Rumours, but it was there. And I logged on, and I discovered that there are 110 pages on this website of Celebrity Rumours. Now, if you want to know the juiciest ones, come and see me later on, but obviously I wasn't looking at them. But it shows the fact that there was a website called Celebrity Rumours and the fact that it was so big, it shows that people want to know stuff, particularly about celebrities. And they probably don't care whether it's true. They just want to hear about people. And if any of you spend any time at railway stations or in looking at news agents, there are rows of magazines where people swapping gossip about each other. And it has can have a profound impact on people's lives. In the passage in chapter 3, how James describes this is he says, consider what a great forest is set on fire by a small spark. And that's like one of these celebrity rumours. Did you hear that Madonna is going to adopt a child from Malawi? Did you hear that... if only I watched television, I would know who these celebrities are. Sheryl Cole is going to become a nun. You know, you could make something up, couldn't you? And you could just see how quickly it was before that got around. Now, sometimes I say somebody to something within the church, and I'm always surprised to see sometimes somebody else in the church will start talking to me about the same thing. Not dangerous, serious things, but and I'll be thinking, how does that person know? I mean, a typical case would be somebody's having a baby. So the sooner you say somebody's having a baby, you've only got to say it to one person, and then whoosh, it's around the church, isn't it? Just like a fire, the spark just goes and off it goes. And it's fine when it's a good thing, like it's good news like a baby, or it's good news like a good job, but also It can be very destructive if it's a rumor or if it's a slander or if it's something which is just even a malicious bit of gossip. Mud sticks, says the saying. And even if you hear something which you think, oh, I'm sure that can't be true. Martin, he's going to be a monk. Sure that can't be true. But then because you've heard it, you think, well, maybe it is true. And so then you kind of take that away with you. And even if it turns out that it's not true, you're still left in the back of your mind. There's like an imprint, like a shadow on your mind where you're not quite sure. So it can be very dangerous. And all of us can think of public figures who've been humiliated out of stuff which is not true. The papers, of course, are the best example of doing this. So if anybody's seen a forest fire, you know that the damage which it lasts, the fire might only burn for a day or two, but the damage which is created can last for years afterwards. And it's the same with rumours. So they've got great destructive potential. And the final terror of the tongue is its uncontrollable nature. So the destructiveness and the impact of the tongue wouldn't be so bad if we could keep control of it, if we could actually take a pill that would keep us quiet. I can see the advantage of being, it's not celibate, is it? What's that one? They take a vow of silence, don't they? I can see why, you know, nuns and monks do that. It has some advantages. But the tongue is uncontrollable. I won't do this, but if I could, I'd say, hands up here who's said anything. In fact, maybe I will. Hands up here who's ever said something, and then they thought, oh, my word. Wish I'd never said that now. I mean, I kind of think that's what the girl from Norwich Union. Ah, there's somebody who's honest. Yes, we've all done it, haven't we? And I think that's what the girl from Norwich Union is thinking now. She's now thinking, I wish I hadn't said no to Martin. That's the biggest regret. So, like, we all do it. We all say things and we think, oh, you know, we're out of control. Even if at the time we think it was okay, it turns out that, you know, we can't control our tongues. And James says, you know, all the animals, the birds, the reptiles, the creatures of the sea have been tamed. So we can tame a lion, but we can't actually tame our tongue. When I read this verse, an image came to mind. Can you put the next slide on, Ian? This is my picture of me trying to tame my tongue. Those of you, if you can't see it, it's a bucking bronco. It's a guy trying to tame a wild horse. And this is kind of how I see us with our tongues. We've got this wild, feral animal, and we're sort of struggling on the back of it to keep it under control. And we don't know how to do it. It's disorderly, it's headstrong, it's insuppressible, it's lawless, it's a loose cannon, it's undisciplined, it's ungovernable, and there we are struggling on its back, trying to get it to do as it's told. But all it does is it's off there being destructive, controlling people's lives, ruining other people's lives, and we're sitting there thinking, how has this happened? What's going on? How am I possibly ever going to control this tongue? Okay, next one, please, Ian. So, those are the three terrors of the tongue. So here we are. The tongue is it's destructive and it's out of control. So if we know all these things, why do we ever open our mouths? I wouldn't blame you if you just decided, from tonight on, it's too risky. Opening my mouth, it's just too dangerous. I don't know what's going to come out. I've got no control. And when it's come out, I don't know how to put it back in again. So why is it that just like small children, something so small causes such a lot of trouble? What is it that's behind the tongue? Who is the teacher of the tongue? Well, interestingly, James doesn't actually tell us who the teacher of the tongue is. In fact, if we just stayed with James, we would all be in despair because that passage in James is basically, the tongue's really bad at this, can't get it to do anything we want, what's going on with the tongue? And then he kind of leaves it there. So we don't really get the solution. James just gives us the problem. We read James and we're like, the tongue is a massive problem. Where are we going to go with the tongue? So for the answer, we have to look elsewhere. If you like, the tongue has committed a crime. The tongue has hurt somebody. The tongue has sinned against somebody, it's sinned against God, it's sinned against us, it's committed the crime. The tongue is the biggest culprit for this crime. But if you look elsewhere in the New Testament, Jesus says something else about the tongue. So it turns out from what Jesus says that whilst it looks like the tongue is the bad guy, it's actually not. If you turn to Matthew chapter 12, if you know the answer for who is behind the tongue, Jesus is talking, he's actually talking to the Pharisees or somebody. Chapter 12, verse 34, it says, "For out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks." So it turns out that in this crime of hurtful and destructive language, the tongue does not act alone. The tongue is merely an accomplice. It is the heart who is the criminal. The true villain is the heart. And the tongue, if you pardon the pun, is merely his mouthpiece. So the teacher of the heart, the one who is behind the damage, the uncontrollability, and the devastating potential of the tongue, is the heart. So, how do we tame? Number three, how do we tame the tongue? We now know the tongue can do damage, and it is the mouthpiece of the heart. If our hearts represent the essence of who we are, they are an indicator of our fundamental nature. The heart is like an advert. The tongue is like an advert of our character. It's like a signpost. It's like a big flashing light over your head. If you're in a canoe and you hear the sound of rushing water, you don't need to see the waterfall to know that it's there. Our tongue literally says more about us than anything else. So, all we need to do to know what somebody's heart is like is listen to what they say. Not only is it blindingly obvious to us, it's blindingly obvious to God. So the bad news is if that anyone was thinking that actually the attitude of their heart was hidden, I'm afraid that we can all read each other's hearts simply by listening to what we say. So, it might not be the godfather of sin like the heart, but even the godfather's henchman is dangerous. And so the tongue is dangerous as well. It's dangerous not only to ourselves, but it's dangerous to others. And the bad news is, if you keep reading in Matthew 12, after it says, "For out of the outflow of the heart speaks the mouth," in verse 36 it says, "I tell you that men will have to give an account on the day of judgment for every careless word that they have spoken." So if you weren't sufficiently worried already about the terror of the tongue, the fact here is that Jesus says that every careless word we speak, God remembers, and he's going to ask us about it when we get to heaven. So that's another reason for keeping quiet and saying nothing. No, it's another reason why we've got to be really careful about what we say. So we're seeing now that the tongue is actually quite dangerous, and we've got to be really careful about what we say. What we say reflects who we are, reflects our fundamental person, it reflects our heart. God can see that, and everyone else around us can see that. So we should be really careful how we talk. So, we need to get down to taming the tongue. It's dangerous and it's going to lead us down a terrible road. But before we can tame the tongue, we have to get a grip on our hearts. We have to pass control of our hearts to God through his Holy Spirit to let us rule our lives. Now, taking a metaphor from the Jewish religion, the Bible describes this process as the circumcision of the heart. And according to Deuteronomy, which is where this phrase is first used, if we let God circumcise our hearts, then we will be able to love God with all our heart and all our soul, and we will live. So, I'll just say that again. If we're going to tame our tongue, we need to tame our hearts. We need to let God circumcise our hearts. And through that process, we will be able to love God with all our hearts and with all our souls, and we will live. And the measure of this process, how far down this road we are, is a measure of our spiritual maturity. So, here we are. We know that we're a mixture of sinful and spiritual nature. There is a battle going on. James alludes to this when he talks about it. He says, at the end of it, he says, can fresh water and salt water flow from the same spring? Can a fig tree bear olives or a grape tree bear figs? He's making allusion here to the binary nature of our character. We're part sinful and we're part spiritual. There is a battle going on, and it's partly up to us as to how we deal with this battle. Now, I'm going to put the next slide up, Ian. This is how we need to get a grip on taming of our tongue. You can probably only read this if you've got really good eyesight, but I wanted to put all these things up here because this is the practical application of what we've been reading here. This is the, if you're sitting in your chair now thinking, well, crumbs, what am I going to do with my tongue because it's a nightmare, I can't control it, and I'm going to be judged by it. This is a speech checklist. This is something which you can think about during the next week to test yourself on what you're saying, to know whether or not you're on the spiritual side or whether you're on the sinful side. You don't need to turn to this unless you want to, but in Mark chapter 7, Jesus is very helpful. In it, he talks again, he gets back to this thing about the heart. In Mark chapter 7, verse 20, he says, "What comes out of a man is what makes him unclean. For from within, out of men's hearts," so we're getting back to this idea that these things come out of your heart. He's just in the same way that he said the outflow of man's heart is his mouth. What he's saying here is out of our hearts also comes evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance, and folly. So, if what comes out of our hearts is our speech, then if our speech is about evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance, or folly, then that is on the sinful heart side. So that's on the left-hand side. All of those things. If we say anything, and actually the root of that, why we're saying that, is based in that area, then we can say to ourselves, right, that's the sinful thing and I've got to do something about this. However, if we're on the road to spiritual Christian maturity, then that will be shown by our fruits. And of course, as we know, the fruits of the Spirit are love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. So if the words of our mouth reflect the fruits of the Spirit, then we know that our heart reflects the Spirit of God and that we are circumcised in our hearts. So, print this off, take it home, and when you speak next week, do a little tick. Am I speaking about slander here? Tick. Am I speaking of gentleness, faithfulness, arrogance? Where is my speech? What is the root of my speech? Now, probably many of us will think, well, actually, that left-hand side, you know, I'm not often speaking. But I read through this thinking, well, this isn't me. I don't do any of these things. But then I think the last four, are most likely. And I was thinking, actually, what do I speak mostly? The last one on the left-hand side, folly. Most of what we speak is just daft, isn't it, really? It's like a lot of what we speak is not necessary. We just kind of say it and it flops out and we think, well, what do we do that for? And although it seems harmless at the time, I haven't said I'm going to murder anybody or be adulterous, but often I do say things that are just a bit stupid. And I think if you can concentrate on saying the things on the right-hand side, then that will give you an indication. And if you want to, why not have a little jar with 10p pieces in it And every time you speak something, and it's off the left-hand side, put a 10p piece in that jar. And when it's full, in about a week's time, give all that money to some charity or something like that. So that's the speech test for you. Listen to yourself. What are you saying? See how much of it is driven by the sinful heart, how much of it is driven by the circumcised heart. Now, don't be too hard on yourself if it's all on the left-hand side, which I'm sure it won't be. Because remember that picture of the guy trying to wrestle with the horse? That's what you're doing. That's what we're doing. We're not taking a dog for a walk. We're trying to tame a wild animal, which James says, under man's sinful nature, cannot be tamed. So we're not dealing with a hamster. We're dealing with a hyena. So it's going to take time. It's not going to happen overnight. But it also is going to take effort. I don't know any lion tamers, but I don't know any lion tamers who just kind of woke up one morning and thought, oh yeah, well, I'll just go off and tame that lion. They all kind of went to a lion taming school or wherever it is that lion tamers go. So we're gonna have to put some effort in if we want to switch our speech onto the right-hand side of that column. And if we're not bothered about getting to that right-hand side, well, that is saying that we don't want our heart to be circumcised, which is basically saying we don't want Christ on our hearts. We still want to be ourselves and do the things that we want to do. So this is a great test for each individual. It's not about preaching. It's about each of us saying, all right, where are we on this speechometer? And it's for each of you to go away and work out for yourself. And if you are still more on the left-hand side, then there's a great handbook to get you to the right-hand side. And that's this. So this is the handbook of the right-hand side up here. This is the handbook for the rebellious heart. It will take time to be trained. But the closer we are to that right-hand side, the closer our hearts are to Jesus, the easier it will become.